Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today, I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, so I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, "The Social Security Reckoning is Finally Coming." Senators elected this November will be in office when America's most popular federal program is on track to run out of money. By Mark Novikoff. Americans have been hearing about the looming demise of Social Security for decades. The number of old people receiving benefits has been increasing much more quickly than the number of working-age adults whose taxes pay for those checks. Yet politicians have let the problem fester for so long that the public could be forgiven for thinking that the crisis would never actually arrive. But it's arriving. For the past 16 years, Social Security has paid out more than it has taken in. This has required dipping into its trust fund, built up over the decades when the baby boomers were in their peak earning years. That fund is on track to run out by 2032. When it does, benefits will have to be cut by an expected 22% across the board to line up with the tax revenue that funds them. Pretty soon, politicians won't be able to kick this can down the road anymore. Senators elected this November will be in office in 2032. So will the next president. They will have no choice but to come up with a way to save the federal government's largest and most popular program, lest they be blamed for its partial collapse. The available solutions are politically tricky, but not particularly mysterious. They involve raising taxes, increasing the national debt, and cutting benefits, or some mix of the three. Even if our leaders settle on a way to keep Social Security solvent, however, they are unlikely to address the deeper problem underlying the budgetary one. A program designed to reduce poverty has morphed into a transfer of wealth to the richest members of our society. In 1935, when the Social Security Act was signed into law, the average person entering the workforce could be expected to die at about 65 years old. Those who lived past that age tended to be too disabled to work, leaving them reliant on their children, if not a local charity or poorhouse. Social Security was designed to ameliorate this problem by levying a tax on workers and their employers and paying benefits to the elderly roughly in proportion to how much they earned during their career. When the checks first went out in 1940, the average recipient received $22.60 a month, or about $550 in today's dollars. Such payments did not require too much sacrifice, just a 1% tax on the first $3,000 of a person's earnings, matched by their employer, because there were many times more workers than there were beneficiaries. The program ballooned over time. Congress voted repeatedly to expand benefits faster than inflation, but the biggest changes weren't purposeful. Because benefits are proportional to what a retiree earned during their working years, America's increasing salaries necessarily made the program grow. So did rising life expectancy. The average 65-year-old now has about 20 years left to live, up from 13 years in 1940. Meanwhile, the pool of workers paying into the system has not kept pace. fertility rates have fallen, and fewer babies mean fewer workers in the future. The number of workers for each beneficiary has gone down 24% since 1990, as more and more is being asked of a smaller share of the population. The unfortunate fact is that Social Security was never guaranteed to work forever. The tax formula is simple. Each worker, along with their employer, pays 6% of their income, up to $184,500. The benefit formula is not. The Social Security Administration takes your highest earnings, 35 years of work, and calculates your average monthly earnings from those years, adjusted upward for subsequent growth in average wages. A progressive formula determines how much of that you'll be paid monthly, assuming that you elect to start receiving benefits at age 67, you'll get 90% of the first $1,300, 32% of the next $6,500, and 15% of the remaining. The benefit side of the equation and the tax side of the equation do not add up to the same number. Thanks to the wage adjustment and long life expectancies, most people receive substantially more money than they paid in. In the aggregate, revenues have lagged behind benefits. There's no reason those formulas would be compatible with each other, Andrew Biggs, a former deputy commissioner of the Social Security Administration, told me. The only reason they ever were was that America used to have enough workers to support its population of retirees. Preventing the program's insolvency is a math problem that involves tweaking the tax side, the benefit side, or both, until they equal each other. This is not conceptually difficult. Stephen Call, a political psychologist at the University of Maryland, runs a poll every so often in which he shows participants the possible reforms, telling them how much each change closes the funding gap. The biggest theme is that people solve the problem, Cole told me, with majorities taking steps that eliminate most or all of the shortfall. Respondents tend to be confused as to why their elected leaders haven't fixed the issue. The answer is, that wasn't that hard. What's all the fuss about? The problem is not that the math is difficult, but that every possible move comes with downsides. Social Security reform is ultimately about breaking promises, Biggs said. Either you raise taxes above the rate that people are used to, or you cut benefits for people who are counting on them. Historically, Democrats have preferred the former path, proposing to raise taxes on the well-off to pay for the program's shortfall, while leaving benefits alone. Republicans have traditionally wanted to shrink the program, although typically in a somewhat progressive manner. After President George W. Bush's unpopular privatization push failed, for example, he proposed a slow flattening of the program by making the benefit formula less generous for all but the bottom 30% of recipients. The Democratic approach has always been more politically popular. Donald Trump was the first Republican to accept that fact. In 2015, as he marched to the Republican nomination, he promised not to touch Social Security, breaking with GOP orthodoxy and thrilling the base. Ever since, the Republican discussion on saving the program has had a distinctly muted tone. A March 2024 white paper by the Republican Study Committee, a caucus that includes most House Republicans, proposed raising the retirement age and gradually moving toward a fat, flat benefit. Neither Trump nor Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, commented on the proposal. Project 2025, produced by the Heritage Foundation, was more shrewd. The 900-page document contained advice for the future administration on how to properly regulate the shrinking population of greater sage grouse, but it contained no guidance on Social Security. Democratic plans still revolve around raising taxes while keeping benefits constant or even increasing them, but they now tend to include a feature designed to keep the party's upper-middle-class base happy. The donut hole. Many of the current Democratic plans uncap the payroll tax, but typically only for earnings above $400,000, meaning that dollars earned between $185,000 and $400,000 would go untaxed, and everyone who makes less than $185,000 would pay the highest payroll tax rate of all. Representative John Larson, a Connecticut Democrat, has introduced many Social Security reform plans over his 14 terms in Congress. "I personally don't think that there should be a donut hole," he told me. But he explained, during the presidential campaign, Biden said that he should lift the cap over $400,000. Larson came to understand why. "Every town hall I go to, I say, raise your hand if you're making more than $400,000, and I've yet to see a hand go up." As Democrats have become the party of the pretty well-off, they have made more and more voters who make more than $185,000 but less than $400,000. The donut hole is one weakness, but every plan has its shortcomings. Last month, Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, and Senator Bernie Moreno, a Republican, announced a proposal to uncap the payroll tax entirely. Their idea gets points for bipartisanship, but it would close just two-thirds of the shortfall, at most, if implemented. Within 3 years, benefits would again exceed revenues. A few plans get the math to work out with sufficiently large tax hikes. Proposals by Larson and Senators Bernie Sanders and Sheldon Whitehouse would uncap the payroll tax, with a donut hole, and raise taxes on investment income. These are large tax increases. A wealthy self-employed couple making $800,000, imagine married doctors in private practice, would face a marginal federal tax rate of more than 50%. Perhaps the biggest problem with these plans is not the new taxes, it's what the new taxes pay for. Conceived as an anti-poverty program, Social Security today pays out most of its benefits not to the poor, but to the middle class and the rich. The bottom 20% of older Americans receive just 7% of the total benefits. The economics of old age have changed a lot since the 1930s. The prices of assets, homes, and stocks have soared. As a result of these trends, the elderly are now America's wealthiest age group, living without children in homes that are on average roomier than everyone else's. No longer are most of them financially dependent on their children. If anything, their descendants are more likely to ask them for help. If the public craves a $1 trillion tax increase on the well-off, there are better ways to spend the money. The federal government already spends about 6 times as much for each elderly adult as it does each child, even though children and their parents are more than twice as likely to be poor. Uncapping the payroll tax would not close the Social Security shortfall, but it would provide enough money to pay an allowance of $4,500 a child to every family in the country every year. Reforming Social Security by cutting benefits for rich people and raising them for poor people would make the most financial sense and return the program to its roots. President Franklin D. Roosevelt designed Social Security for the elderly, not because they were uniquely deserving, but because, as he put it in his signing address, they were so poverty-ridden. But that scenario, flattening Social Security and focusing future generosity on the young, doesn't seem particularly likely. Social Security's popularity comes from its universality, and if well-off people see their benefits reduced, the program could lose some of its widespread appeal. As I reported this story, many wonks recited to me the old political adage, "Programs for the poor make poor programs." Indeed, most voters, when faced with the choice, prefer tax increases to benefit cuts. A poll last year by the National Academy of Social Insurance, a network of social safety net researchers, showed that the three most popular reform options were slightly different ways to uncap the payroll tax. The next most popular was an increase in benefits. Even raising the payroll tax rate on everyone by 1 percentage point ranked above cutting benefits only for the rich. Broad-based bipartisan majorities say they'd even be willing to chip in a little bit more themselves, Rebecca Vallis, the head of NASI, told me, if that's what it takes to prevent benefit cuts. A social safety net that so heavily favors the old and rich over the needy and young is probably not what most Americans would design if they were starting from scratch. But it's what we have. The likeliest outcome of whatever Congress comes up with in the next 6 years is that same dynamic, only more so. And that completes the first article today. The title was "The Social Security Reckoning is Finally Coming" by Atlantic staff writer Mark Novikoff. Our next article is titled, "Let Them Eat Gold." Taxpayers are now financing President Trump's love of anything gilded, by Matt Weiser. When you approach the freshly gilded twin statues near the Lincoln Memorial, there is no mistaking that they are gold. Very, very gold. Distractingly gold. Or more precisely, covered in 23.75 carat gold leaf, costing $5.1 million. The 19-foot statues, called the Arts of War, were once easy to miss, but now look a bit like oversized children's trophies, especially next to the classical and austere Lincoln Memorial. Seeing them is as if, on the walk between Arlington National Cemetery and the National Mall, you'd suddenly stumbled upon a P.F. Chang's. This is how President Trump is approaching his redecoration of Washington, glitzy and gaudy, even if out of place. He has already splashed gold all around the White House, but these statues are the most prominent symbols of Washington's new Gilded Age. As the scaffolding around the statues came down this week, marking one of the few completions of a Trump-ordered renovation project, the president giddily posted photos on social media, and tourists commuters, cyclists, and runners pause to take photos of their own of the Capitol's latest Can You Believe It attraction? Trump has worn his love of gold like a blinging billboard. Mar-a-Lago's ballroom is inspired by Versailles, and he has proudly bragged of golden bathrooms, golden airplane seat belt buckles, and a gold-infused penthouse suite. The Oval Office now looks like a Middle Eastern bazaar crossed with an opulent Cracker Barrel. Thick gold frames line the walls. Gold vases and ice buckets adorn the fireplace mantel. Gold stars form a circle on the ceiling, and gold appliques fill any gaps. Trump insists that these are real gold and not painted flourishes from Home Depot. Last year, he exempted gold bullion from his reciprocal tariffs, and he named his special visa program for wealthy foreigners the Trump Gold Card. He has taken his personally designed presidential challenge coin, which is golden, and glued it to the center of the Oval Office door at about eye level. The coasters are gold, the curtains are gold, and guests know to come bearing gifts of gold. When FIFA president Gianni Infantino awarded Trump the first FIFA Peace Prize, it was a golden orb of a trophy. Apple chief executive Tim Cook presented the president with a 24-karat gold base to hold a glass sculpture. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last year gave him a golden pager to commemorate an operation in which members of Hezbollah were killed when their pagers detonated. "See," he said, during a meeting with his cabinet in March, while rifling about all of the projects he'd launched in Washington, "I'm a gold person." It's one thing for Trump to have a personal fascination with one of the world's most expensive metals. It's another for the president to flaunt it at a time when many Americans are struggling to pay rent, losing their health insurance, and seeing high prices at the gas pump. It may not quite be a let-them-eat-cake moment, but it is one when he seems to be saying, "Let them see I just spent $5 million in taxpayer funds on golden statues." Trump, for decades, has loved gold and marble, liberally sprinkling them about his development projects and his personal spaces. Ivana Trump, his first wife, who was the Trump Organization's vice president of interior design, encouraged Trump's gold obsession, according to Regime Change, the recent book by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan that has a golden cover. Ivana's love of the color proved lasting. She was buried in a gold casket. In the 1980s, Trump bought Mar-a-Lago in South Florida and went on to put $7 million worth of gold leaf on the walls, plus gold-plated sinks near the ballroom. He hired the designer Henry Conversano, known for infusing golden flourishes in the Golden Nugget casinos, to remodel his Trump Tower penthouse apartment and work at his Atlantic City casino. In 1988, he purchased from the Sultan of Brunei a yacht that was bathed in gold, couches, sinks, ceilings, and named it the Trump Princess. It was so gaudy, almost shockingly gaudy, and he loved it. He thought it was the most beautiful thing out there, Jack O'Donnell, one of Trump's former casino executives, who helped him host parties on the boat, told me. he speculated that Trump may have been inspired by the yacht when he remade the Lincoln bathroom, almost entirely in gold and marble. Years later, in 2008, when Trump built a hotel in Las Vegas, the 406,000-square-foot facade was coated in a layer of gold-infused glass. More recently, when a group of Trump supporters erected a 22-foot statue of him at his golf course in Doral, Florida, they opted for a gold finish. To him, gold was the essence of richness and class. Barbara Reese, who oversaw construction for the Trump Organization and was placed in charge of building Trump Tower, told me, "To him, it meant, this is gold, this is mine, it's the best you can get, and I'm the best. That's how his mind works. I'm going to show you the best by buying the best." Sometimes, she said, it wasn't the best. It was a cheaper alternative that looked like gold but actually wasn't. Although she found that he was willing to spend his money for something that was his idea. He liked the design concept trompe l'oeil, a French word that means deceive the eye, where painters could make a column that looked like marble. It was tricking the eye of the consumer. He loved it, Rez said, and he took an interest in the gold finishes. It reflects his taste and his ability to spend endless money on something beautiful. That's what he wants people to believe. Whether it's in his long red ties, his schwoosed-over hairstyle, or his thank you for your attention to this matter social media posts, Trump is all about branding. Perhaps nothing is more on brand for him than his affection for gold. I love the gold, but if you don't use 24-karat gold, it doesn't look good, he told reporters last August. It just beams, he marveled in September. It's all real stuff, he said in March. You can't imitate it. Someday they'll discover a paint that will look like gold, and the guy's going to be the richest man in the world. Peter York, a design and culture columnist, wrote in Politico magazine in 2017 that Trump's design style is aspirational, meant to project the wealth so many citizens can only dream of. Although it's often associated with Italian Renaissance or French Baroque, York says a better comparison is more recent. The best aesthetic descriptor of Trump's look, I'd argue, is dictator style, he wrote. Gold has often been used to represent imperial power, whether in 18th century France or 19th century Russia. When Trump went to the Middle East for his first foreign trip of his second term, I watched as he marveled at the gold and marble in the palaces of Doha and Abu Dhabi. Versailles is not a gold leaf, he said in June, ahead of a trip to the palace. Versailles is the real deal. The two Arts of War statues, called Valor and Sacrifice, were sculpted by Leo Friedlander and cast in Italy. They were dedicated in 1951, offered to the United States as a gift from the Italians for helping rebuild their country after World War II. Each statue shows a nude man and a semi-nude woman. Two other statues, collectively called the Arts of Peace, are nearby, but still undergoing their golden glam-ups. Each of the statues sits on a granite pedestal, ringed with 35 stars, representing the states in the Union at the end of the Civil War. The statues, cast in bronze, were last regilded in 1971 and had since faded. Trump added them to the list of eyesores he wanted fixed before the nation's 250th birthday on July 4th, and federal officials scrambled to meet his demands. When I reached out to the White House to ask about the project, the president's role in it, and his choice of gold, the spokesperson David Ingalls responded with a statement that made no mention of gold and said, in part, "No other president has done more to beautify our nation's interior than President Trump." He said that the president's bold vision was ensuring that the 250th birthday was filled with glory and pride. He referred other questions to the Department of Interior, which did not address any of my questions about the project, its delays, the choice to heavily apply gold, or Trump's involvement. Residents and visitors are excited to see the city revitalized to the grand destination it was meant to be, the department offered in a statement. Federal officials did not seek competitive bids for the work on the statues, bypassing the typical process and awarding a contract in April for $5.1 million. The project was treated as a high priority by the National Park Service, according to the New York Times, which cited internal documents that referred to it as a visible, high-impact example of how the NPS is responding to presidential directives. Extensive market research was not done to determine whether $5 million was a fair price, according to documents obtained by Notus, and the agency determined that only one company could meet the requirements of the work and the timeline, the Gilder's Studio in Maryland. The company, which did not respond to my message, has done a large number of regilding projects around the country, including the dome of the Georgia State House, the cupola of Faneuil Hall in Boston, and perhaps most similar to the statues in Washington, the Sherman Monument in Central Park. A description of the project had a mandatory competition date of July 1st, but for the past few weeks, as it had for the months before, the scaffolding remained up, and tarps read, "We are making D.C. safe and beautiful." Only now is the project coming into view, and although Trump is clearly pleased, others are less so. "Fit for an oligarch's ballroom," a review in Art News reads. As I rode my bike past the new gilded statues Friday morning, I couldn't help but wonder what would next succumb to Trump's Midas touch. If a triumphal arch is constructed across the bridge, will it be just as glaringly golden? Will Trump cast the John F. Kennedy statue outside the Kennedy Center in gold? Is Abraham Lincoln sitting nearby at risk? Or the pensive Thomas Jefferson standing in the dome across the way? How far will Trump's new golden age extend? And that completes the article. The title was "Let Them Eat Gold" by Atlantic staff writer Matt Weiser. I'm going to take just a couple minutes to remind those of you who may have tuned in late, you're listening to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I'm reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. Continuing on with this article, "When Middle Age Actually Starts: Trying to Attach Some Numbers to a Fuzzy Phase of Life," by Julie Beck. The only thing anyone can reliably tell you about middle age is that it's in the middle of life. What's the middle? Well, it's after the beginning and before the end. Okay, we can do a little better than that. Middle age comes after young adulthood, and before we used to call old age, but now might more decorously refer to as older age or late life. But to get more specific, to figure out when precisely middle age begins and ends is a daunting challenge. The average life expectancy in the United States is 79. So if you cut that in half, 39.5 is the precise statistical midpoint of the average American life. But that doesn't reveal much. Middle age isn't just a point in time, but a phase of life. How long does that phase last? When does it start? When does it end? How can you tell you're in it? These, it turns out, are very fraught questions. I am 35. Is a 35-year-old middle-aged? If you ask my friends, they'd be quick to say, I am still young. But the word still carries a note of reassurance that I find troubling. Is a 66-year-old retiree middle-aged? Maybe, maybe not. But they sure don't want to be called old. Is a 29-year-old middle-aged? Surely not yet. The Wall Street Journal ran a story a couple of years ago about 20-somethings who claimed they felt middle-aged. When pollsters ask the populace about when middle age begins and ends, they get a variety of answers. In one survey, the median response put middle age as lasting from 40 to 60. In another, the average British person said that middle age begins at 35, hello, and ends at 58. Meanwhile, 55% of Americans think 65 is still middle-aged. And according to that journal story, 20% of people ages 25 to 34 say they feel middle-aged. If anyone could authoritatively answer the question, when is middle age, I figured it would be Margie Lachman. She is a psychologist studying midlife at Brandeis University and the author of the recent book, Prime Time, A New Vision for Midlife. She also worked on the massive longitudinal Midlife in the United States, or MIDUS, study for all of the 30-plus years it's been running. Yet even she cannot decide on a firm definition for when middle age begins and ends. Her official definition in her book and her research is 40 to 60, plus or minus 10 years. Even among scholars, the boundaries of middle age are fuzzy. One reason for that fuzziness, Lachman told me, is that how you think about middle age depends on what age you currently are. The older people are, the later they tend to think middle age starts and ends. According to data Lachman shared from Midas, people in their 20s define middle age as starting around 39 or 40 and ending around 53, 54, or 55. Those numbers inch up with each successive decade of life. The oldest group in the study, people in their 70s, say middle age begins around 48 or 49 and ends from 62 to 65. Ageism is likely to blame for a lot of this. In a youth-obsessed culture, it makes sense that people want to consider themselves young for as long as possible. In Prime Time, Lachman writes that she's found that many people in their early 40s actively resist the idea that they are middle-aged, and many in their late 60s or 70s insist that they are still middle-aged. Indeed, research shows that the older someone is, the later they think old age begins, too. And middle age has its own branding problem. The number one word attached to midlife is crisis. Chip Conley, the founder of the Modern Elder Academy, an organization that offers workshops for making the most of midlife, and the author of Learning to Love Midlife, told me. This association persists despite evidence showing the midlife crisis is mostly a myth. On top of that, the appearance of aging itself is changing. Celebrities get plastic surgery, Botox, and fillers to retain or restore youthful faces, and are more open about it than they once were, further confounding how we perceive the phases of life. Saying the 70-year-old Kris Jenner is old feels odd when, after her much-publicized facelift, her facial skin is stretched so taut you can scarcely detect a single wrinkle. Even the faces of ordinary people who don't get work done are generally aging more slowly, the cut reported, because overall people smoke less than they used to and use more sunscreen. Wrinkle-reducing retinol is widely available in creams, gels, and serums at any old drugstore. Anti-aging is now such a normal part of beauty routines that even some children are using products to prevent wrinkles they're nowhere near having. This isn't the only factor shifting back our aging goalposts. Many milestones that people once used to define adulthood, marriage, home ownership, having kids, are happening later in life, if they happen at all. Given the association of middle age with responsibility, perhaps people don't feel middle-aged unless they're tied down in some way. Indeed, some of the 20-somethings who said they felt middle-aged attributed it to becoming parents or taking on major work responsibilities at a young age. Also complicating the definition of middle age is the fact that people are living longer, and as they do so, their quality of life in their later years will vary depending on their physical and cognitive limitations. Because American culture has such a negative view of what it means to be old, all aches and pains and forgetting where you put the car keys, if someone is aging and feeling good, they may think, "I can't possibly be old, because I can do everything I want to do," Latchman said. And if they don't feel old, they may continue to identify as middle-aged well into their 60s and beyond. Increasing longevity is one of the reasons that Conley sees middle age as a very long stage of life. He believes it lasts from 35 to 75 in three stages: early midlife, from 35 to 50, the core of midlife, from 50 to 60, and later midlife, from 60 to 75. Although 75 might seem to be pushing it, given that Americans' average lifespan is 79. Conley pointed out that, for math reasons, the longer someone has lived, the longer they are likely to live. That is to say, 79 is an average that takes into account all deaths from people of all ages. And if you make it to 65, you've dodged many of the things that might have killed you when you were younger. According to the Social Security Administration, the life expectancy of a 65-year-old American is actually 83 for men and 86 for women. And if I haven't seen anyone try to claim that an 80-something is still middle-aged. Latchman played along gamely as I fixated on the numbers, but really that's not how she likes to define middle age. Chronological age does not tell you much about anybody, except how long they've lived, she told me. She prefers to think of middle age in terms of the roles people take on in their life and in their community. Being middle-aged to her means truly being in the middle, having people both younger and older than you looking to you for help and guidance. That might mean you're in the sandwich generation, caring for children and starting to support aging parents. Or it might mean you're a leader in your workplace, mentoring younger colleagues, and relied on by older ones. In midlife, you're going to give more than you're getting in general, Latchman said. This definition of midlife also has ambiguous boundaries, which Latchman readily admits. But despite the vagueness around when middle age actually is, both she and Conley believe it's a useful term. Being in the middle of anything, I think, is a really meaningful point, Latchman said. It's a great opportunity to look back and look ahead. At this point in my quest to define middle age, I started losing my grip a little. If you want to be precise about it, a life really only has one beginning and one end, and the rest is all middle. So a 2-year-old could be middle-aged. A 90-year-old could be middle-aged. We're all born middle-aged, and then we die. Just kidding. Ultimately, middle age might be better understood as a feeling that creeps up on you than as a clear turning point. No one thing brings it on, though parenthood, caregiving, and other responsibilities could fuel it. It's a time of life that is often both exhausting and fulfilling, when you've lived enough life to have learned some lessons and also have plenty of time ahead of you to make changes. That might be accurate, but it's still not satisfying. I want the numbers. So I ask Latchman, if you have to choose, when does middle age start and end? 45 to 65, she said. So there you have it. I'm officially still young for 10 more years, if anyone's asking. And that completes the article, When Middle Age Actually Starts, by Atlantic staff writer Julie Beck. The final article today is Why is the U.S. Running So Low on Weapons? By Phillips Payson O'Brien. Although the United States has been the world's preeminent military power for decades, it apparently cannot fight a regional power such as Iran for more than a few months before experiencing an armaments crisis. Since hostilities with Tehran began on February 28th, the U.S. has reportedly used up 2/3 of its Patriot missile interceptors, more than 1/3 of its terminal high-altitude area defense interceptors, and 1/3 or more of its pre-war stock of Tomahawk cruise missiles. The rate of consumption is all the more striking because a shaky ceasefire had halted most fighting for months. Based on recent production patterns, replenishing the supply of weaponry will take several years. Making America's challenge still more daunting is a major shift in warfighting technology toward cheap unmanned aerial vehicles. The United States and its allies in the Persian Gulf have been forced to use expensive, advanced air defense systems, such as Patriot PAC-3 missiles that each cost millions of dollars and have a long production cycle, to shoot down Iranian drones that can be swiftly assembled for about $30,000. The munitions shortfall doesn't just affect the current war, it also sends a worrisome message to allies around the world. The United States has been caught off guard by the latest evolution of warfare and lacks the armaments production capacity to adapt quickly. Suddenly, relying on American military technology looks far less reliable as a security strategy than it did before President Trump went to war with Iran. And in the long run, governments that counted on the United States to equip their military are going to need a Plan B. In the short term, concerns about diminished weapons stocks are already limiting Washington's strategic options. Because of his advisor's concern about the adequacy of current supplies, Trump has reportedly been hesitant to escalate the war. If the United States decided to send ground forces into Iran on the scale necessary to keep the Strait of Hormuz open, defending those forces could exhaust the remaining stocks of advanced air defense systems. After a short period, American troops would be far more exposed and casualties far more likely. Trump and his appointees during his current and previous terms bear only part of the responsibility for the current situation. The fundamental problem has been a bipartisan neglect of America's military industrial productive base over the past three decades. The United States allowed many of its strategic industries, such as shipbuilding, to wither. Its post-9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan involved brief invasions followed by years of relatively low-intensity counterinsurgency warfare. That, whatever its difficulties, did not require mass stockpiles of munitions. Informed by these experiences, military planners appear to have been operating under the assumption that future wars would be short and containable. If China attacks Taiwan and the United States wants to come to the island democracy's aid, the Pentagon will not be prepared for a protracted war. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has failed to learn from the war in Ukraine. Iran has learned to mass-produce cheap drones, ones that the Russians first imported and now produce themselves. In other words, their effectiveness has been tested, and their existence was widely known. But that seemed to make no difference to U.S. planners, perhaps in the arrogant belief that a war with Iran would quickly end in a decisive victory. The Pentagon did not have cost-effective systems ready to intercept these weapons. Neither did the Gulf countries that have counted on American weaponry for their self-defense. In contrast, Ukraine has proved remarkably adaptive to emerging conditions, creating a powerful strategic industry, as Ukraine has done in the case of air, land, and sea drones. Not only helps with the country's security, it also provides a boost to Ukraine's economic and strategic position, as governments in the Gulf and elsewhere seek to tap its expertise. The Gulf partners that build their militaries around equipment from the United States do so under the assumption that in a moment of need, they can get what they require from the superpower. Perhaps the U.S. would even carry the burden of any war in the region. The perils of such assumptions are becoming apparent. Relying on any other country for weapons is dangerous. Doing so may create a flashy frontline force with some advanced capabilities. But once the purchased equipment is destroyed or worn out, the military that bought it is left with troops trained on equipment that it cannot make, and with a military doctrine built around equipment it might never have again. Sometimes allies drag their feet or change their mind. Ukrainians have used American military equipment to great effect, but the unreliability of those supplies, because of President Biden's fear of antagonizing Russia and Trump's usual favoritism toward Vladimir Putin, has hampered their war effort. Since Trump's return to office, traditional European allies have come to recognize from his criticism of NATO that they will need to rely more on their own resources for their security. The current munitions crunch could lead its Gulf partners to the same conclusion. If Saudi Arabia and other customers of the American defense industry start sourcing their military equipment elsewhere or making it themselves, the United States will lose out. Beyond improving America's military position and diplomatic leverage, arms exports have been a lucrative industry. If the United States appears less powerful and less reliable than it once was and is running through munitions faster than it can produce them, many more countries will follow Ukraine's example. The Pentagon is belatedly ramping up its efforts to develop less expensive, self-guided weapons. But those initiatives so far seem inadequate to address the problem that the war with Iran has revealed, a gap between America's military needs and what it is capable of manufacturing quickly and cheaply. And that completes the article. The author, Phillips Payson O'Brien, is a professor of strategic studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He is the author of The Strategists, Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, Mussolini, and Hitler, How War Made Them and How They Made War. His article was titled, Why is the U.S. Running So Low on Weapons? And that completes the broadcast today. You've been listening to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles I've read today were from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in July or August of 2026. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.